Hi, folks. I'm Creighton Pendarvis, and I'm an alcoholic. I haven't found necessary to take a drink, go to jail, or steal anything over $50 since the 1st of March of 1976, and I'm very, very grateful for that this afternoon. When Diz called me, I've always been a substitute. You know, I've always been second. But I'm delighted to do this. This is not the first time I've done a step study, nor will it be the last, but the way I'd kind of like to do it this afternoon is very briefly just kind of go through the steps very briefly and kind of share with you how we get to 10 and 11 and 12. Not to embarrass anybody or anything, but how many people do we have in their first 60 days of sobriety? Okay, got one. Okay. Now, I'm not talking about golden slippers. I'm talking about your really first 60 days of sobriety. Okay, good for you. How many people are in their first year of sobriety? First year or 2 years? Okay. You're probably like I am, and I'll talk about this Sunday morning, but I was about 6 weeks sober, and sitting in the AA hall on a Saturday afternoon, and I was, as we say in AA, I was between engagements. I was a dishwasher, and I had recently been an airline pilot, but at the time I say I was a China mechanic because dishwasher sounds so, you know, just so gauche, you know. And my sponsor came in, and I was washing the floors of our AA hall, setting the chairs up for the Saturday night meeting. My sponsor came in, Ken Halstead, and God love him, he was a great guy. He wasn't very affectionate, but that afternoon he sat down beside me, and I had taken a seat about where you're sitting there, and he sat down next to me and gave my shoulders a little squeeze, and with all the sincerity in the world that he had, he said, "Son, what step do you think you're on?" Now, I'm sober 6 weeks, okay? And without batting an eye, I said, "Well, Ken, I'm having some trouble with number 9. Well, on the floor he is, and I think, my God, he's having a heart attack, you know, laughing himself to death. You know, the tears were running down his cheeks, and he got up, and he put that big old bony finger in my chest, and he says, "Boy, you're on one, and don't you forget it, you know. And it's times like these that the new members of AA want to crush their sponsor to death in the AA parking lot if they only had a car, you know, but I didn't, so. But let me share with you, you know, how we get there from 1 through 9. Of course, the first step, and I'm going to read, I keep sliding off of here. I'm going to take this off like that, and that'll make that work a lot better. I'm going to read what I think perhaps will be one of the most important things I read this afternoon, and this comes from step one. And if your sponsor asks you where in the big book where step one is, you can now tell them. It's on page 30. And chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And let me read this for you, because this will set the tone for what we're going to talk about for the next hour. By the way, I don't think anybody, a speaker, should talk over an hour or an hour and 5 minutes, because you can't sit still any longer than that. And my ego used to have me talk longer than that, but my prostate's bigger than my ego now, so that takes care of that, you know. Well, most of us, this chapter 3, more about alcoholism, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think that they're bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Here's the kicker. If you've got a yellow marker, here's the kicker for newcomers. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And that tells us where our first step is, right there. We come to AA, and I came to AA. I'd had a fantastic education. I'd had a fantastic life. I'd done all the manly things, all the macho things that a man could ever do. I was a professional football player. I was a paratrooper. I was a fighter pilot in combat. And I was an airline pilot, flying all over the world. Done all these manly things. But when I came to AA, my life was just as unmanageable as somebody on Skid Row. By the way, through a series of misunderstandings and a little tough luck, when I came to AA, I lived under a bridge in a Lady Kenmore box. And I didn't make $286,000 a year anymore. And I had 40 cents to my name. Now, I'm straight alcoholic. I'm just a, you know, just a plain old drunk. I was drinking Aqua Velva. It was my drink of choice when I came to AA. That's, I can't see an ad, one of those ads these days, without just, you know, shuddering when I see one. But that's where our first step is. It tells me that I, first of all, I have to convince myself that I'm a drunk. Just as simple as that. And if I can't do that, then I haven't got a Chinaman's chance. Now, there's a lot of people that I'm looking at out here in this audience, and boy, do we clean up good. You're a good-looking group, I'll tell you. When we clean up and we sit here like we're sitting right now, there may be some people in here that doubt that they're an alcoholic. Don't think a thing about it. For the longest time, I didn't think that I was. But you were nice to me. It was cold out. I needed a place to stay. And I had drunk a little too much. And, you know, when I came to AA, I had an old pair of marine green wool breeches with the zipper was rusted shut, yellow tennis shoes for the same reason the zipper was rusted shut, a raggedy shirt, and a leather flying jacket. And I thought just a series of misunderstandings, a little tough luck, and drank too much, you know. But the word alcoholic had not entered my mind. I knew about alcoholism in 1950, February the 10th of 1950. My father got sober in Charlotte, North Carolina. And that summer, I'd gone to live with him. He'd been a bad drunk. And I'd gone to live with him that summer of 1950. And in July, he hocked a beautiful vicuna coat and a Crosley radio, and we went to the first international in Cleveland in a 1948 Pontiac. So I was one of the first, come on in. They got plenty of room here on the first row. Beer's cold, but you can sit right down there. Last one in buys, by the way. So just make yourself at home. Glad to have you. And so I was an Alateen before there was an Alateen. There's about 17 or 18 of us kids there. What did I know about that? What information did I glean from all that experience? Because I was went to a lot of open meetings in 1950 as a puke 15-year-old pimply-faced kid. What willpower people had. What willpower you people had. And we know today that willpower doesn't have a bloody thing to do with it. Willpower is not a disease, and alcoholism is a disease. And it's the disease concept that we have to accept up here before we can do a bloody thing. Step two tells us that. Step two tells us why we can't sometimes accept step one. Because we're crazier than a peach orchard boar. Step two tells us what? Go ahead and read it. Came to believe that a power greater. Now, where are you going? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. People who are sane do not have to take that step. Step three, which is my favorite step. And sometime, I'd been sober not very long, and I was living in a little flop in the Ben Bolt Hotel in North Kansas City, Missouri, and the members had taken up a collection for me to put me in there, and I'm probably the only one in the room that early in the program couldn't sleep, you know. Probably the only one in the room. But I tossed and turned and flopped and flipped, and my conscience was eating me alive. And the guilt and remorse were sleeping with me and wake me up every 15 minutes and say, good morning, good evening, Creighton. Here we are again. And I didn't have the drink to make him go away. But what I did have was this big book that I stole, by the way. And for newcomers, before you get real honest, if you can't pay for one, steal one. You can pay us back later on. But what happened was simply this. What happened was simply this. My big book flopped open to page 63, and I read this. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter, we were reborn. Now here a guy is that is so guilt-ridden and so full of remorse and self-centered fear and anger, and I'm reading that, and I'm reading that, that a new life is going to happen to me. But let me share a glimpse of what God does for us. Something happened to me, and I believed every word of what I read. And then the next paragraph is what? The third step prayer. And I read that by rote. And all of a sudden, I was reading, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as Thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Now, I got to tell you, that I didn't think much about that, except I dozed off, and I got the most blissful night's sleep that I've ever had in my life. Now, was I well into the third step? Of course not. But just by reading that, just for some reason believing what it said at that time, something happened to me that changed me, and I was on my way. Now, that prayer has become the greatest thing in my life. Page 63 saved my life. Literally saved my life. Remember. And you'll hear the rest of the story if you stick around Sunday morning. But I got that license to fly airplanes again, and I was flying 707 out over the North Atlantic one stormy night in the late 1990s. And I lost an engine, and it was bumpy, and it was rough. And all of a sudden, I was doing the silence the bell, you know, fire the bottle. And but the same token, I was saying, and take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those. And the guys in the cockpit were looking at me like, what is he doing? He's going through the checklist, and he's talking about this other stuff, you know. But I was saying the third step prayer at the same time I was going through my emergency checklist. And God must have heard it, because we did just fine. But I say that prayer a lot. So there's step three. Now, by this time, when we're at this point, we've asked God to do something for us. First of all, we've admitted we're drunk. Secondly, we've admitted we're nuts. Thirdly, we're asking God to relieve us from the bondage of self. Let me share this with you. The next time that you hear How It Works read, pay very, very close attention to when it says, constitutionally incapable of being honest with yourself. For years I wondered, what in the world do they mean by that? It simply means you can't look in the mirror. That's all it means. You can't look in the mirror. Because who do you see in the mirror? The monster. And that's why we drank. That's why we drank. So we didn't have to face the monster in the mirror. That's all that means. So by this time, we're able to look in the mirror, hopefully a little bit, by the time we're at step three. And we're convinced that something's happening to us because we're going to these meetings, and that sponsor, Black Slick, like Diz's sponsor, would be banging on that door. honk, honk, honk. And you're out there sitting in the car, just madder than a wet hen that you have to go to these silly meetings. And he says, how are you doing? And you're just blistering mad, and you say, fine. I'm okay, you know. And we come to these meetings, but something is said in a meeting, either by somebody who is brand new or has been around for a long time, but something is said that you grab a hold of all of a sudden, and it gives you the impetus that you can live another day, and maybe, maybe, just maybe, if that crazy so-and-so can grab a hold of this, maybe I can too. And then maybe you'll go home and turn to page 63 and say, God, relieve me of the bondage of self. I'm so tired of me. I'm so sick and tired of me. The only problem is me goes with me every place me goes, and I get so sick and tired of me. And take away my difficulties. Well, by that time, we're ready to get rid of some of these difficulties, and how do we do that? Fourth and fifth step. The fourth and fifth step. Pencil and paper. Directions are in our book. A lot of people are paying a lot of money to different organizations all over the United States to get a fourth and fifth step guide. There's a beautiful one here in our big book called Alcoholics Anonymous. You can get that for $5. You can tell it didn't cost me $10,000 to learn how to read a $5 book, can't you? Anyway, we get into our fourth step. And in our fourth step, we're as honest as we can possibly be. Now, I took my fourth step fairly early. I was about 8-9 months sober. And my sponsor was constantly, how's that fourth step coming? Fine, fine. Yeah. Hadn't done a darn thing. Well, I'm working on it, you know. How's the fourth step coming? Fine, fine, I'm working on it. So finally, what happened to me was that the third step was so pressing on me that I wanted to relieve me of the bondage of self that one day I started sitting down and I started writing just like it tells us how to do when we get into page 65, and it's the outline. And it shows me how to do it. And I started doing it, and before I was halfway through, a lot of garbage had come out of me. Was it perfect? Of course not. You know, when we're born, alcoholics, and some Al-Anons. Now, I'm not making fun of Al-Anons. I've been in Al-Anon 16 years. And if you sponsor drunks, you ought to go to Al-Anon. But anyway, when we were being born, we were coming through this assembly line, and God Himself was stamping on the final coat of insulation on all our feelings. And as we came through that for that final coat of God to stamp insulation on all our feelings, invariably somebody would say, "Hey, God," and He'd say, "Yeah," and right on through, and no insulation. So here we are, and we're just wired backwards and funny. We're just wired funny. So we get here, and by the time we get to step four, we've got so much garbage that we're carrying, we're apologizing for living, for goodness sakes. Now, some of it, of course, we need to write down. Some of those amends, yes, we need to write down. We do have some sins about Mr. Brown and Ms. Brown and this and that and the other thing that it talks about in there. But, you know, we're not carrying the weight of the world on our shoulders. If you're writing that, that's fine. That's fine. You know, it's one of these deals. When you take your fifth step and you do it as honestly as you possibly can, leaving nothing out, it is one of the greatest feelings in the world. Immediately? No, not for most of us. It takes a while to realize what we've done. And I would swear to goodness that if you don't take your fifth step with somebody that's been around this program for a long time, or a priest, you're foolish. Now, that's just me. You need to take a fifth step with somebody that understands this program, and also that word called what? Well, God, but what else? Privacy. don't be like my dad. I asked my dad, I said, because I was getting ready to do my fifth step, and I said, how'd you do yours? And he said, well, son, I went down to Tryon Street in Charlotte, that's Skid Row. He said, I found me an old wino. I bought him a jug of Mad Dog 2020, took him out in the woods, in the piney woods, fed him that jug, told him the whole thing, and then killed the son of a bitch. And I said, that really wasn't the way he did it. But privacy is very, very important when you're doing your fifth step, because that way you can share your experience, strength, and hope with somebody, and it's not going anyplace. Now, there's three things to the fifth step. I'm going to get to 10, 11, and 12 in just a second. But there's three things that you have to do in order to make it a thorough fifth step. Number one, you have to go in to someplace private, and you have to look at that monster in the mirror, and by this time, you're able to look at that monster in the mirror. It's no longer a monster. It's not the greatest guy or greatest gal you ever knew in your life, but it's somebody that you can look at and look them in the eye and tell them all about you. Hardest thing I ever did in my life was the captain looking at the captain and realizing that I wasn't such a big deal after all. I was about as unique as a Chevrolet. And I had to tell me all about me. And then the next thing I had to do is I had to sit down with my sponsor, David. And I had to tell David all about me. And then I had to, as soon as I finished that, I had to go back in that bathroom and stand in the stall and tell God all about me. Three separate things that I did. When I came out of there after that fifth step, I was pretty well purged. I was wrung out. I was wore slick. But in the days after that, I didn't have anything to hide anymore. Now, had I forgotten some things that I hadn't written down? Yes, of course. In fact, when we're driving down the highway and we see somebody driving down the highway that goes, oh, they've just thought of one of those things that they need to include, you know, in another first fifth step or call their sponsor when they get home. Six and seven. Two shortest paragraphs in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous are six and seven. But in the 12 and 12, what does it say? In number six, it says what? Separates the men from the boys, or the boys from the men, or the ladies from the girls, or whatever you want to say. And number six says what? What is the key word in number six? Willingness. 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 Remember, folks, we're not perfect. We never will be perfect. There's not one of us in here that'll walk in that closet and glow. And there's not a soul in here that can walk across that swimming pool. We're just not perfect. But willingness, the willingness to get rid of our defects of character, are going to cause us to be better people. In here, what is it doing? It's going back to step three and relieving us from the bonds yourself is what it's doing. See, these steps are so intertwined. And then if we're willing, then we can get down on our knees and humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. The spring of 1977, I had moved up from China mechanic, dishwasher, I was peddling food for a food broker out of Kansas City, and I was traveling northwestern Missouri. And there's an abbey up there called Conception Abbey. Now, I'm not Catholic, but I thought it was just a beautiful abbey, and I was working with the brothers up there, the Benedictine brothers, and the birds were chirping this April morning, and the flowers were blooming, and everybody seemed to be just happier than a lark, and the brothers were talking, and that was different, because they didn't talk. But they were talking this day, and I said, Brother Thomas, what's going on? He says, this is our feast day. This is the anniversary of our abbey. Our abbey is 200 years old today. Why don't you go over to the abbey and take a look inside. We've got it decorated a little bit, and this was a huge abbey, you know, right out of the movies. Great big cathedral type thing. Well, I'm not big on abbeys, but I went over there and I went through those oaken doors at the front, and almost as if on cue, the Gregorian chant started from the cloisters. And the monks had gathered back there, and these Gregorian chants started. I'm not big on Gregorian chants either. But what happened to me is I stood in that center aisle, and a shaft of light moved from behind a cloud and came down and was shining in front of me with these Gregorian chants. And I fell to my knees, and I cried like I hadn't cried since I was a little bitty boy. And I knew there was a God, and I knew that God loved me, and more importantly, I loved God. And I was so grateful for what had happened to me, that for this puking, as Chuck Chamberlain used to say, tongue-chewing, babbling drunk, that had crawled out from under a bridge, dressed in their wardrobe, with not a suit of their name, was now sober and could talk, could complete a sentence, and I didn't have to look over my shoulder near as much as I used to. And I cried and cried and cried, and I humbly asked God to remove everything that stood in the way of my love for Him. Make a pathway for me. And that was step seven for me. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, you had that experience, and if I saw a burning bush, you know, I might faint or this, and I haven't had that experience. You will have if you hadn't. It could be in your own bathroom. It could be in your car. It could be sitting at the coffee table looking at the lady you've been married to for 10, 20, 30 years. It could be sitting at the table looking at your husband. Or it could be looking at that brand new baby or grandbaby. How lucky we are. And then all of a sudden, out of your mouth will come, or out of your thought process will come, God, I humbly ask you to remove my shortcomings because I don't want to live like this anymore. Relieve me from the bondage of self. You see, take away my difficulties. So, now we're through with seven. Now we're ready to really get into it. And God's given us the ability to get this far. And we're not afraid to face those people that we owe those amends to. Especially the material amends. For some reason, the material amends scare most drunks more than anything else. So we sat down, just like the big book says, with paper and pencil in hand, and we start writing, and we start that list of the amends that we need to make to people. People amends. For this, that, and the other. And we make the list as thorough as we can, because now our mind is fairly clear, and we've been relieved of enough of the bonds yourself where it's a little easier for us to admit to ourselves. And our ego is out of the way now, as much as possible. And all of a sudden, we start writing these amends, and at step eight, we have all these amends written. And then in step nine, what do? We do the tough one, don't we? We do the tough one. A lot of people think that in step nine, that we have to have a reply. Isn't what the book says. What does the book say? It says we're sweeping off our side of the street. It makes no difference if we ever receive a reply, in words to that effect. I'm paraphrasing. But we're sweeping off our side of the street so that we can walk free men and women at last. We don't have to look over our shoulder anymore. Now, I didn't realize that at first. I had a lot of... I was bad about hanging paper. I'm probably the only one in the room that ever did anything like that. But I was bad about hanging paper. So, my sponsor and I used to take my check to my sponsor from my China mechanic job and then later from my food brokerage job. And I'd take him, and I was scared to death to open a checking account because I didn't want to write any more hot checks. That had been relieved from me. And I was scared death of a checkbook. So my sponsor kept the checkbook for me. And every Friday night after a meeting, now you talk about embarrassing. You know, I got, allegedly have more degrees than a rectal thermometer, and I was a captain on a 707. And I had to sit back in the back room and sign checks that my sponsor held the checkbook for, you know. Big butter and egg man, yeah. And we would write these checks out, and we'd mail them, paying back for these hot checks that I'd written. And I'd written the letters to them in my night step that I was doing the best I could. And I didn't say, I'm an alcoholic and a member of AA. He says, don't you dare put that in there. Just tell them that you're trying to make amends for some awfully bad behavior. And 99.9% worked with me. And then I had to go downtown Kansas City and make an amend to a clothing store. And as my sponsor said, probably the most poignant words I ever heard in my life, because I went down there and I said, well, I really didn't do anything that bad. He said, you stole. And I said, well, I didn't. I just didn't pay the bill. And he says, you know, that's the only difference between you and somebody in Jefferson City, which was the state penitentiary, is you didn't hold a gun to the guy's head. But you still stole from him because you didn't pay your bill. So I walked in to this clothier's and I saw the owner and he was talking to somebody else. And he saw me out of the corner of his eye and he came right over and I was all set to, you know, make my amend. And he says, pay me! And I thought, this isn't the way it's supposed to go, you know. He's supposed to be a little more humble about that. He says, I don't want you in this store ever again. The only thing I want is for you to pay me. And I started to say, but I can only start pieces. Just pay me. So I held out, I think it was $20, and he grabbed it out of my hand and turned on his heel and walked away. And I went out to the car, and I was, you could just tell that I was just really unhappy. And I looked in the car, and that old car was shaking, great big Cadillac, longer in this room. And Ken, that was my sponsor at the time, puffing on that cigar. And the whole car was shaking. He was laughing so hard, you know. And that old rotten cigar smoke was just pouring out of the windows. And he said, what happened, boy? And I said, well, he took the money, but he wasn't very happy. I learned my lesson. And I paid that man. And I learned that a lot of times the things that we've done, the lives that we've destroyed, will never be the same. I had a 17-year-old daughter that I deserted, she and her mother. And I wrote a letter, or I had a 17-year-old daughter. I had not seen a daughter in 17 years. I had a 2-year-old daughter that I had not seen in 17 years. And I wrote her a letter of amend. And I got a letter back from her because for a long time I didn't. But I kept asking Ken. I said, you know, I've written her. I've poured my heart out to her. And look, that's the thanks I get. And he says, whoa. And we went back to step 9 and reread it. He says, you're sweeping off your side of the street. You may never get that. You may never, ever, ever get that letter. I did get the letter. It said, Dear Daddy, I love you. And from a daughter I hadn't seen in 17 years, she says, I understand about the disease of alcoholism, and I want to see you. And we saw each other. And I'd like to tell you that, you know, that it was, we picked up where we left off 17 years before, and it's not true. Too much water had gone over the dam. But at least we were speaking to each other. We were working with each other. Okay. So that's what happens in these steps. What I've just gone through is how these gets up to our 10th step. By now in our 10th step, we don't want to make any more wreckage of the past. Lord knows we've got enough. So the 10th step is put there so that we can make our amends on a daily basis. So that we don't have to do what? Live with the bondage anymore or the monster anymore. Now, I would like to tell you that I, you know, I don't have to make a lot of 10-step amends. My wife would kick me if I said that. I have to make a lot of 10-step amends. Because that monster every once in a while crawls up. Especially on the highway. They don't realize that it's my road out there. State of Georgia, state of Alabama, state of Mississippi. They don't realize that you can use it after I've passed, but that is my road. Well, I have toned my driving down at 67 years old. I'm a heck of a lot more cautious driver than I used to be, and that has been relieved. I've been relieved from the bonds itself. A lot of things that I used to do, I don't have to do anymore. And it makes me feel good that I don't have to do as many of those amends as I used to. Now, just before we came down here, before I came down here, my wife and I had a round or two. I've got to tell you, tell you this, and I'm sincere when I say this. It sounds jocular, and it really isn't. Let me ask, how many people in this room have been married to the same person for over 20 years? Look at that. Look around. Over 20 years. I'm not one of those people. I wish I were. How many people have been married 30 years? That's fantastic. Any more than that? Look at that. That's just absolutely amazing. That's what the program of AA and Al-Anon does. Unfortunately, I'm like, we kid about it. It's not very funny, but there's a bumper sticker allegedly going around that if you've been married to Creighton Pendarvis or Sandy Beach, honk, you know. Well, if I'd been married to the same woman, I would have been married 43 years. But I haven't. I've been married several times. In fact, I have rice burns. I've been married so many times. I'm not happy about that. And I wish to God that I was one of you that had could have stayed with one wife. But my behavior was unacceptable. My actions were intolerable. And I went through a lot of people. So when I do my 10-step amends, I have to not only apologize for what I'm doing today, but I also have to apologize to those people that I've hurt in the past. That you say, well, that's 9-step work. Well, I still have to write letters to them when I think of things that I've done. Thank God, thank the good Lord, that I have a wonderful relationship with all my ex-wives. A wonderful relationship. In fact, I found out that there's one thing that helps more than anything to restore those relationships. It's called paying alimony on time. You know? What a difference that makes, you know. The lady that I'm married to, this is my last wife. I may be her current husband, but she is my last wife, believe me. I've known for over 50 years. We met in college 50 years ago. She was Miss This and Miss That. She was the cheerleader. She was the vice president of the class. She was smart. She was beautiful. She had great big blue eyes and long wavy hair. And I was in love. But I was a nasty old jock, a dirty old football player. And so we didn't hang around in the same circles. We went to our 40th reunion and we both had families. And we met at our 40th college reunion. And kind of had an eye for each other. And we married 7 years ago. And we've got a great, great relationship. She has not embraced the program of Al-Anon. She was married to an alcoholic before. He was a bad alcoholic who found AA after they divorced. And he passed away, unfortunately. She has 3 wonderful children. But she works the Al-Anon program pretty good, even though she doesn't go to meetings. What I have to apologize for is my behavior these days, is my behavior to me. I don't allow me to give me the freedom sometimes to be a kind man to myself. The hardest thing anybody in this room will ever do is forgive themselves. Okay? Now, 10th step talks about a couple of things that I'm going to read about. How are we doing on time? Okay, how much more time do I have? 15 minutes? 20? These people can't sit still for 20 more minutes. How many prostate problems do we have out here? You know, I see some old bald heads there just sitting there twitching pretty bad in the seats. Well, the pens, you know, I forget they got the pens now and all that stuff, and June Allison and all this. I'm on page 90 of the 12 and 12. It is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. If somebody hurts us and we are sore, we are in the wrong also. But are there no exceptions to this rule? What about justifiable anger? Hey, justifiable anger has gotten me in more trouble than I care to share with you. Okay? If somebody cheats us, aren't we entitled to be mad? Can't we properly be properly angry with self-righteous folks? For us of AA, these are dangerous exceptions. We have found that justified anger ought to be left to those better qualified to handle it. Everybody in this room has probably suffered from justified anger. But if you'll think back to the monster, how about those other people that could just as well, perhaps better, have justified anger at us? Did I make myself clear on that? Okay. Remember that when we start getting angry about so-and-so did this to me, who in the world am I talking about? I've done so much crap to other people and gotten away with it that I don't have any recourse at all about this justifiable anger thing. Also, it does two things for you. It raises your blood pressure, and it causes you to have to go back to step 3 and ask for relief of bondage yourself. Because the monster will come back in the mirror. I guarantee it. I had the last time the kids, grandkids were over, which was about 3 weeks ago, I went in the living room, and we have this beautiful new huge screen television with a remote control that my six-year-old is training me to use. And my six-year-old grandson and his two-year-old brother was putting peanut butter inside of it. And I wanted to kill him. Instead, I picked him up and I loved him, and I gave the control to the dogs, and they licked all the peanut butter out. So yeah, took care of that. Few people have been more victimized by resentments than we alcoholics. It mattered little whether our resentments were justified or not. Let me read this one more time. This is third paragraph, page 90. Few people have been more victimized by resentments than we alcoholics. It mattered little whether our resentments were justified or not. A burst of temper could spoil a day, and a well-nursed grudge could make us miserably ineffective. Nor were you ever skilled in separating justified from unjustified anger. Read that one more time. When it comes to figure out whether it's justified or unjustified anger, we're dumber than dirt. We just can't figure out which is which. Well, by George, they did it to me, and I'm going to do it to them. As we saw it, our wrath was always justified. Anger, that occasional luxury of more balanced people, could keep us on an emotional jag indefinitely. These emotional dry benders often led straight to the bottle. Other kinds of disturbances, jealousy, envy, self-pity, or hurt, pride did the same thing. Therefore, a spot check inventory is necessary. We just have to stop in mid-sentence and say, whoa, time out. Back away, sit down, get in the car, drive down to the Dairy Queen, drive around the corner, wash the car, wash the dog, do something, but get away from him, her, or them, and cool off. My wife and I went to a marriage encounter. Now, I'm about as excited to go into a marriage encounter as I am as drinking poison, but I'm mellow now, so we went. One of the best times I ever had, put on by the Presbyterian Church. And they had this, I thought he was a goof, you know. This guy got up, and the first day I thought, oh, we're going to hold hands and play these silly games, and I need a meeting, you know. And what we did was one of the most important things he said. He says, you got to realize that two people don't necessarily think the same way. You may think you're talking about the same thing, but you're not. And he held up a Time magazine. He says, what's on the front? And I forget, it was a picture of somebody. Let's call it the woman of the year was on the front. And what's on the back? Well, it was an advertisement for a Ram Charger truck. And he says, and you think you're talking about Time magazine, but you're holding it up. She's talking about the woman of the year, and you're talking about that Dodge truck. And you think you're talking about Time magazine. He says, so our watchword, or he said, I suggest that you have a watchword now and slow down and talk about these things. And the watchword can be either time out, and so Patty and I call it Time magazine. And before we start into one of our discussions, one of us will say, Time magazine. And that stops the whole thing. And we pull back a chair, and we sit down. Now, we may be red in the face, but we sit down, and we calm down, and it's Time magazine. And 8 out of 10 times, that settles the issue. And what it does, it allows us to give our side of what we were talking about, and usually we're talking about the same thing from different perspectives. And that's all step 10 is talking about. Giving yourself an opportunity to work with another human being. And what that does, it lets the mind clear up so that we can get into step 11. And when we get into step 11, we talk about what? Prayer and meditation. There are so many ways that we can get into prayer and meditation, it isn't even funny. There is no wrong way to do meditation. Let me emphasize that. There is no wrong way to do meditation. I don't care if you're 15 minutes in the program or 25 or 27 years in the program. You can still do meditation. What is meditation? Meditation is some thought process that comes in your mind. It may be something on TV that causes you to think about something in a very pastoral way. It may be somebody saying something that gets you to thinking. It may be in your church. It may be on the highway. It may be a tape, an AA tape. Some of the first meditation I ever did were listening to AA tapes. Excuse me. The old 8-track tapes. In the early days of when tapes were a new thing. Meditation, any way you want to do it. There's a book that I just love. And this book is called God's Fool. Now, it's not AA approved. But neither is the Holy Bible. So, you know. It's called God's Fool. It's written by Julian Green. What it is, it's the story of St. Francis of Assisi. Now, if you think that St. Francis of Assisi was always a saint, read this book. He was one of us. He was a dandy. He had a lot of girlfriends. He had a lot of money and did a lot of things with a lot of people that weren't very Christian. And all of a sudden, he had an awakening and became one of the greatest friends that AA has ever known through his wonderful, wonderful prayer that's in our big book. Or, I'm sorry, that's in our 12 and 12 in the 11th step. And we all know what that is. And it simply says this. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. How many people in this room sponsor people? You know what? You've done probably every one of these things that he talks about. Every one of them. That's meditation, if you will. Meditation is sitting down and listening. One of the hardest things for a drunk to do is listen. Really, really listen to what another person is saying. Especially that new person, when we think we have all the answers. But you got to realize that we know that person better than their mother does, or their father, or their sister, or their brother, or their wife, or their husband. We know them better than anybody else in the world, and we've never met them before. And we will be the first one to do what? To give forgiveness, to give understanding, and to give love. And that's all the 11th step is. Step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I hear that read so many times, and it's as a result. And no. The result of these steps does what? Enables us to work with other people. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. What does it say? Hello? Okay. Work with other alcoholics and practice these principles and affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening, by the time we're doing 12-step work, we've had a spiritual awakening. If you haven't ever done a 12-step call, you haven't had an experience. Now, with all the jitter joints and the spin dry units going out of business, we're getting a lot more opportunity to call in the wet drunks. I'm not throwing rocks at treatment centers. I'm really not. They do a lot of good. But we're getting a lot more opportunities to make 12-step calls on wet drunks. When you call on that wet drunk, don't ever go by yourself. Don't ever, 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 ever go by yourself for several reasons. And not the least of which is, there's a guy that was a good friend of my dad's and a friend of mine from Atlanta, Georgia, by the name of Doc. Anybody remember Doc from Atlanta? He's dead. Went on a 12-step call by himself. Been sober a long time and forgot that axiom. And opened the door, and a young man who had called him for help killed him with a shotgun blast. and that's bad for you. Go with somebody else, especially if you've got a new pigeon. Oh, Lord, take that new pigeon with you. You'll have more fun than the law allows. They'll look like a tree full of owls, and they walk in and see that old drunk on that couch, you know, full of spit and urine and everything else. And you'll sit down there, and you'll share with that alcoholic and listen to all their garbage and be with them. And Sunday morning, you'll hear me talk about just exactly what I'm talking about now, how I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what the members did to save my life. Don't ever forget this. Don't ever, 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 ever forget this, that we, you, the faces I'm looking at, have the ability. I don't care if you're a ditch digger or a bank president. You have the ability to save lives. And I'm dead serious. I am dead serious. You can save lives. You have that ability. It's the God-given ability that God never bestowed on anybody else, doctors, nurses, or anybody, unless they're a drunk. Because the drunk will listen to you. I went on a 12-step call with Ken. He'd been sober 23 years. I was 6 weeks sober. And we went on a 12-step call on this wet drunk. And Ken gave him the pitch, talked about 15, 20 minutes. And that drunk was sat there nodding. And Ken was giving him the best shot. And the drunk says, "Whoa, wait a minute." He looked at me and he says, "How long have you been sober?" And I said, 6 weeks. He says, "How the hell did you do it?" He couldn't believe that anybody could be sober 23 years. But somebody might be sober 6 weeks. So you have the power. You have the power that's been given to you as a gift. As a gift by God. To save another alcoholic's life. And that's a precious gift. Just as precious as it can be. I'm going to finish up. I have three freedoms now that are absolutely fantastic. I was given my license back. It was taken away from me. There's only two of us in the world as professional airline pilots that ever got their license back after they were taken away from us for DWIs in airplanes. One was Lyle P., who I sponsored when he first got sober, and his story's in the big book now in the fourth edition, and the others myself. Out over the Pacific Ocean, sitting in the left seat of a 747, flying from Los Angeles to Australia, I would look out, and it would be a beautiful, beautiful day. Sunshiny, gorgeous, gorgeous day. And I'd get tears in my eyes because I would look out there and I'd think, if this whole Pacific Ocean were nothing but Johnny Walker Red Label Scotch, there isn't enough of it for me to cause me to take a drink. What a change that is. What freedom I have today to be able not to have that desire, that compulsion to take a drink. And my second freedom is, I don't have to compare myself to anybody anymore. I don't have to try to be the big butter and egg man anymore. I don't have to be somebody. I used to spend money I didn't have, buying things I didn't want, trying to please people I didn't even like, going all over the world. And I don't have to do that anymore. I can just be Creighton Pendarvis from Chanute, Kansas. And what a freedom that is. What a freedom that is. And the third freedom I have is I don't have to judge anymore. And perhaps that's the biggest one. I don't have to judge you. I don't have to judge my wife. I don't have to judge my children. And I sure as heck don't have to judge AA. Because with one finger pointed this way, there's four more pointed back at, three more pointed back at me. And nobody ever listened to me anyway. I think we've got time to say the Lord's Prayer and finish this thing up. It's been a true, true pleasure to share steps 10, 11, and 12 with you. And I've enjoyed it, and I've gotten something out of it. Hope you have too. God bless.